The following episode may contain inappropriate material. Listener discretion is advised.
You're listening to the PVD Cast with John Orlando.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another installment of the PVD Cast. I am your humble host and your podcast purveyor, John Orlando, and welcome to episode number 384. I hope all is well with you out there, and thank you very much for checking out this episode of the PVD Cast. Just this past weekend was the annual event held in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, called the Three Rivers Comic Con. And I mention that because that particular event is going to come up in the conversation I'm going to have with my guest here in just one moment. I would like to say that I was a huge fan of the Three Rivers Comic Con. I haven't been there in the last, well, we'll say 4 years because of COVID. And a couple of my friends that always seem are busy when that time comes around to make plans to go. But it's a great convention. You should definitely check it out if you're, you know, in the area. If you're a couple of hours drive, stop on over next year when they have the Three Rivers Comic Con and see some great, cool vendors, creators, etc., etc. And as I'm talking about creators, one of the individuals that showcased his work at the Three Rivers Comic Con is my guest. Tom Zoller is the man behind Love and Capes and a whole bunch of other projects that we're going to talk about. But Tom was there. In fact, I'm going to freely admit, I was scrolling through the guest list, just checking out who was going to be at Three Rivers Comic Con, and I saw that Tom was an Ohio guy, and I'm like, you know what, I'm going to reach out to him. And he was nice enough to take a little break from his schedule and sit down and chat with me. All right, before I throw it to a quick break, I just want to mention, as just a short little, you know, kind of reminder that I have a great sponsor. World's Greatest Comics is that comic book store. I appreciate their support throughout the years, and I'm just going to keep it a little bit short. I'm not going to go on and on real quick, but I just always like to highlight that if it wasn't for Jeff and the fine folks at World's Greatest Comics, I wouldn't have a great sponsor. And so with that, I'm going to go ahead and throw it to a quick break. And on the other side of the break, you're going to hear my conversation with Tom Zoller. Ladies and gentlemen, this evening I'm sitting down with a cartoonist, a creator, a man about town, and we'll just call him that as well, Tom Zoller. Tom, how you doing, man?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing well. I do thoroughly enjoy, on your website, your bio, the legend of Tom Zoller that was up there. That's why I had to go with the man about town, just to kind of try to one-up you, but clearly you are the master of your own biography, shall we say.
I had a friend that after seeing Down With Love, have you seen that?
No.
Peyton Reed, it's designed to be like a 60s screwball comedy with Renee Zellweger and Ewan McGregor. And in it, every time they refer to his character, Catcher Block, they're like, Catcher's Block, man's man, ladies man, man about town, Catcher Block. So I have friends who will say, Tom Zoller, man's man, ladies man, man about town, Tom Zoller. So I'm trying to get that to stick.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about a couple of your projects, and we'll talk a little bit about yourself as well. So let's start off with Love and Capes. It is a superhero rom-com, I think, mm-hmm. as you described it on your website, between a bookstore owner and a superhero named the Crusader. So my big question is, why did you go the avenue of a rom-com in the world of indie comics?
I had done a book before Love and Capes called Raider, which was a spy adventure book. And it didn't go great. That's why nobody's heard of it. But in the third one, there was a character that had like a Batman Catwoman relationship. and I found I really liked writing banter. So when I was looking for my next project, I wanted something lighter, I wanted something smaller, and like the in-between moments always seem the coolest to me in superhero books, because they're never touched on for too long. Like, what would you do if you had those kind of superpowers? You know, the scene of Clark and Lois making the souffle in Superman 2, or, you know, they would do that in Lois and Clark all the time where he'd fly somewhere to get them food. I thought those little moments would be really cool to explore and really delve into the relationship part of it.
Whom did you base some of those characters off of? Like, in other words, the books, is it a pretty much a, you know, Lois and Clark type of archetype?
Yeah, that was the baseline. They're all like the Silver Age archetypes, because they're so common, you don't have to explain all the details. You don't have to explain that this guy has powers like Superman. He just looks like Superman enough that you know he's got powers like Superman. Mm-hmm. Like, you know everybody falls into, and I don't have to bore you with an origin story or something, because that's not what the book's about.
Talking about another project that you worked on is a comic called Long Distance, where you have two individuals who kind of start a relationship because they've been snowed in at an airport for a while. Mm-hmm. So my question is this, have you ever had a long distance relationship? Is that why you decided to do this book, or?
Yes, I have had a few. some of it is that I meet people at comic book conventions. So like, you're never in your hometown. There was a contest TV show on Bravo called Situation Comedy. And it was kind of like Project Greenlight for sitcoms. And I had just gotten out of a long distance relationship, and I was still fond of it. And I thought it would make a really good TV show, because instead of falling for the will they or won't they, you get into the how they. Mm. And like text, okay. I did it as a sitcom script, and then I came back to it and texting had become a thing. And okay. Then like just the idea that you have a constant telepresence with people. Like you're in contact to a level that you weren't able to be in contact before. I just thought that was really interesting to explore. I think a lot of people either have been or will be or know people who are in long distance relationships. And I thought that was ripe for dealing with. And if it had ever become a sitcom, the idea was that they would keep moving around, that there were two people who loved each other, but they also loved their jobs. Their jobs would occasionally cause them to relocate. So it'd be the two of them chasing each other around for some indeterminate part of time.
Okay. Yeah, I can remember a long distance. I've only had one, and, you know, driving on the weekends 2 hours away, you know, mm-hmm. back to your hometown to hang out. It presents some challenges.
Yeah, like everything goes really fast and then really slow.
Yeah.
Like I dated someone in LA from Ohio, and like it's a really long first date, because it's like, you know, a weekend and then you leave for, you know. So it's weird and rough and cool. And yeah, I just thought it was, you don't see a lot of that explored. And especially like in the long form thing, you can really get into some of the more interesting parts about it. Like what happens the first time one of you gets sick and you can't be there for them.
You know what? That's interesting. And I also never thought about it, but when you mentioned about technology, mm-hmm. you're right. I mean, technology has rapidly changed a lot of our social interactions, you know, for both the good and the bad. And I, you know, when I was involved in my long-term relationship, it was way before that, you know, mm-hmm. in the 90s, you know, you didn't have that. And I guess that was something I just kind of never thought about. That's a very valid point, that today it's probably much easier than it would have been 10 years ago, 30 years ago, et cetera, et cetera.
Like, I'm old enough that I remember, even with friendships, that because I went to art school in Jersey, and I had friends from there that I would talk to over the summer, but you have to deal with long distance rates, and you would have to, like, if you were going to call them, you almost had to have a reason to call them. Like, you couldn't just call them to go, you know, and that obviously this is before internet, you know, say, hey, I just saw a movie and I know you'd know who's the guy who was in the background of this one scene, because you know that stuff. Like, you couldn't just contact someone for like the stupid little stuff. It always had to be the huge stuff, because you were making a call and interrupting them and getting, you know, AT&T charges. But now, you know, I can text people and say, oh, this really ticked me off. And they're like, yeah, that was right. You know, the stakes are so much lower when you contact people.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, upset on that one. Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about Warning Label. Can you give the listeners kind of a brief summary of that project without, you know, without giving too much away?
I don't know if you know this, but I do comic book conventions and I pitch my book a lot. Yes, I can absolutely do that. A warning label is about a game designer who's cursed by her ex-boyfriend that every guy who asks her out gets the warning label of what they need to watch out for.
Oh, okay. So they get the same warning label with her, or does it vary?
Yes. What you find out is that there's a guy who sticks with her. He winds up writing a label of his own, but real early on, you find out that the list can be changed. And it's only knocking stuff off the list. One of the conceits is it's speaking about whatever character flaw she has when the curse is implemented. So if she becomes a worse person some other way, we never get into that. Okay. And it's not that she has to change her mind as much as her attitude on things. So the first one that comes up is that she doesn't really share. But in the course of this date, she opens up to the guy that she's with and tells him everything that's gone on and how much it bothers her that she has this warning label. And suddenly it goes away. And it's not that she has to always open up and be open to people every time. It's that suddenly she sees how that can be an advantage. And then it goes away as one of the things kind of against her. And like I said, he writes, it's only on paper, but he writes one of his own. So they're kind of on equal footing.
What was the inspiration for this tale?
I had come up with this as an idea. I used to do a 48-hour film festival from friends in LA. And when you do that, you can't really start ahead of time, but you know what you have to work with. You know, these are the actors, these are the places we can film, that kind of thing. And I just got the idea of someone walking into a bar and having that happen because I thought that would be funny. And then what happened was years later, I got to meet the editor at Webtoon, and he had picked up Long Distance and asked me to pitch a few things. And warning label kind of came once I realized the idea was that the list could be changed. That gave me a whole story. Otherwise, it's a 7-minute cute concept for a film. But once you get into the how do you get things off the list, that becomes a story.
OK. You mentioned comic book conventions and off air real quick. Yes. Most recently, you were in Pittsburgh at the Three Rivers Comic Con. Mm-hmm. How was it?
It was good. I had a lot of fun. They have their own beer. That's awesome. I got to hang out with some friends there, too. So I haven't been to Pittsburgh before. It's weird because, you know, they're of course, my hated enemies, being a Browns fan as much as you can be a fan of the Browns. So going into Pittsburgh was great. But no, it's a gorgeous city. Super great time.
I will let you know in advance. I'm a Steelers fan, but I have a lot of respect for the Browns, and people think that that's like me just talking out my ass or whatnot. But no, I feel like you that city got screwed and then got a franchise back, and they don't take it for granted now. Like Browns fans are Browns fans. They're sold to it. They don't take it for granted. I mean, granted, the team is not always great, but
no. No, there's a level which I always, once they left, I felt like the Steelers were the Klingons to our Federation. Like they were honorable warriors. I mean, clearly barbarians, but honorable warriors. But the Ravens were like the frickin' Borg, soulless automatons. But also, it was always a mixed household when I was growing up. My mom's cousin was Chuck Knoll.
Really?
Yeah, cousin or second cousin. But yeah, She rooted for the Steelers. She rooted for whatever team he was on. So she was a Browns fan when he played for the Browns and then was a Steelers fan when he coached the Steelers.
Oh, wow. That's really cool. All right. Well, let's talk about a couple of things that you've worked on for IDW.
Okay.
You've done some work with a title called Time and Vine. Mm-hmm. And also a title that many of us know, especially folks that grew up in the 80s, My Little Pony. So let's talk about Time and Vine first, if you don't mind.
Sure.
What's the basic summary of that project?
It's about a magical time-traveling winery that when you go into the winery and you drink a bottle from 1912, you go back to 1912.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Someone, I think it was Kurt Busiek, posted some sort of story prompt or something about doing a comic based on a winery, and the whole idea just clicked. Like, it was not supposed to be my next project, and it's one of those things that came to me virtually fully formed, and it worked out so well because I knew that I wanted it to take place on the East Coast, because if you're going to time travel, I wanted to time travel through, most of American history, and you get more of American history starting off on the East Coast. And it turned out that the oldest winery in the United States, oldest continuously operating winery in the United States, is in New York. upstate New York. So I got to go out there for reference. You can't write off your wine bills, but you can write off your trip. But no, it's super fun to do the research. And Cleveland, or the Grand River Valley, east of Cleveland, about half an hour from me, has a lot of really good wineries. A guy that I went to high school or grade school with was a sommelier out there. And he gave me a tour. And yeah, I just did a bunch of research and then started writing about a time traveling winery.
With that project, how did IDW become involved in the project? Like, in other words, how did that opportunity come to take that project to IDW?
So when I was doing Love and Capes, at one point, I started off self-publishing and I was looking for someone to turn it into a trade. And I was lucky enough to be friends with Harlan Ellison, who walked it into IDW twice. They said no the first time and Harlan is like, oh, they're wrong. I'm going to take it to this guy. And then months later, Chris Ryle called and said, hey, I want to publish this. So they started doing the trades and then Diamond got difficult and they started doing the regular book. So once Love and Capes wrapped, I went to them with a couple other projects and that's why they did Long Distance and that's why they did Time and Bond. The publisher for a while was the guy who was a publisher, not that he ever stopped being a fan of mine, but he really liked my work. I was kind of like, wasn't so much their art house guy, but like they really liked the stuff that I did. So I had an open door to publish for them with them for a while.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about My Little Pony. I guess I have to ask, which of the ponies is the best one to, I guess, work with? Not that that sounds oddly phrased, but you which one's your favorite to deal with or to draw? You
know, it changes. Usually it's whatever one I'm writing. But most of the stories that I ended with were Pinkie Pie and Cheese Sandwich, and they were my favorites. Pinkie Pie was a lot of fun to write. You could do so much with her, and I don't know how deep you are into the My Little Pony universe.
I'm not too deep into the mythology, so okay. Go ahead. You can educate me as much as you like.
In the very last episode, they jump ahead an indeterminate number of years, and you find out where the characters have landed. And then IDW, after the cartoon series ended, did a couple years worth of stories that filled in the gap between the second last episode and the last episode. And in that intervening time, Pinkie Pie and Cheese Sandwich get together. Cheese Sandwich is voiced by Weird Al Yankovic. And they kind of set out the call and they're like, who wants to work on stuff? And I said, if you let anyone else write a romantic comedy for My Little Pony, I will get quite angry. My father worked for the post office. I know things. I pitched a bunch of Cheese Sandwich stuff for them. Cheese Sandwich and Pinkie Pie.
Okay. Cool, man. Mm-hmm. Weird Al. I did not know that.
Yeah. Yeah. I there's also a character voiced by William Shatner. Ooh. I wrote a story that had him in it just so I could write the Mr. William Shatner pony. That was the entire reason I did the story.
Did you have to like elbow people out of the way in order to get that story?
No, nobody was looking for him. Like he just makes an appearance, but I got Shatner to sign the book for me. So,
oh, nice. Yeah. Cool stuff. It's been mentioned many times on the PBD cast that I have yet another project in the works. That project is the Larry Hankin Stories, a Patreon page that contains tons of cool content about everyone's favorite actor, Larry Hankin. Larry just released his autobiography, That Guy, and is offering a huge deal for his fans. You can get a 25% discount if you buy the book through Bear Manor Media. Just plug in the code THATCODE4, THATCODE, the number 4, and you can get 25% off your purchase of the book. Just go to bearmanor-digital.myshopify.com to access their catalog of great books, put in that code, and you will get 25% off. But hurry, because this offer only lasts until midnight on July 4th, 2023. And also, don't forget to check out the Patreon page. It's over at patreon.com/LarryHankin. Let's talk about a story that has a unique twist on a mythology that we all know, and that, of course, is Cupid's arrows.
Okay.
Two of Cupid's, I guess you could say, henchmen, if you will, or angels, or I don't know what would be a good adjective for them.
I've always thought of him as hitmen.
Hitmen. Okay. Yeah. Two of Cupid's hitmen out and about doing Cupid's bidding, and they themselves may fall or succumb to their own, attraction mm-hmm. to one another. How did this project come about?
So when I was working with Webtoon, Warning Label did really well, but it always had a concrete ending. There was only so long I could emotionally abuse that character, but they wanted something else. And being kind of falling into writing romance stuff in comic books, I'm kind of a utility infielder, but because I write romances at Webtoon, I'm a left-handed reliever.
Okay.
So because those are so romance focused, some of it I think is just the vertical scroll because you lose scope, you lose width because you're never wider than the phone. So it tends to be a lot of relationship stuff. And I wanted something that was open-ended. I wanted something that I could do, you know, that I could keep doing stories with that didn't have a, I knew how it would eventually end, but didn't have a clearly defined ending. And, mm-hmm. you know, I could come up with more stuff. So it kind of has that old TV show Mission of the Week take. And then mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of the Thin Man movies with Myrna Loy and William Powell. And I wanted a couple that were like a wacky bantering couple that would go around and have adventures and go from town to town. And so there's an overarching story that happens with Rick and Laura, but then they get involved with individual relationships along the way.
You mentioned the Thin Man. I am very excited because we have a an old-timey theater here in Columbus that shows old movies.
Okay.
And that's on the docket. It's,
oh, is it?
It's at the end of the month, and I'm very okay. excited for it because I've always heard about that series, but never, I don't know why. I guess because I just, you know, oh, I'll get to it eventually. But
right.
It's coming to the theater, and I'm like, oh, we got to go. I told my girlfriend, we have to go. I've heard
excellent.
Nothing but great things about it. So yeah. I'm very stoked for it. I know that was kind of a little bit off topic,
no,
but
no,
nonetheless, you know.
No, it's such a fun series. And I know it was a TV show. I've seen an episode or so. And the episodes don't hit me the same way as the movies because the leads just have such charm to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I continue to not know why they haven't remade it. You just need like that USA casting director who could, you know, partner up so many great things on USA Network. Like there's a movie called Undercover Blues with Dennis Quaid and Kathleen Turner. And those two, they have the chemistry to do it. Like they could have done it. Because it's not a hard concept. It just has to be written super well.
Yes. No, which is
yeah,
probably
that's
the biggest,
hardest part.
Yeah, that's the hardest part for lots of things. Mm-hmm. speaking of writing, you've done some writing for some pretty big titles such as Disney XD's Spider-Man Web Warriors and mm-hmm. Knights of the Zodiac for Netflix.
Yep.
What's your process when you sit down to write? Do you outline things? Do you kind of rough drafts? Or do you just plunge right on into it? Or does it matter?
It depends what I'm working on. When I'm working in animation, most of the time, the stories that I've done, I've been given mostly what the story was about, and then I had to craft the script for it. When I'm working on my stuff, like Love and Capes, I'll know the beginning, I'll know the ending, and I'll know a couple things in the middle. But a lot of times I will just barrel forward because I'm just too dumb to make notes and just go forward. And I'm doing this long enough where I feel like my brain thinks in 24-page increments. Like the only place I ever got into trouble was the third year of Love and Capes. I had designed Love and Capes to be three arcs. Like I did the first issue and said the first issue will stand on its own. But if that succeeds, then I'll do six and I'll do each one like a season and every year will end cleanly enough so that I could walk away if I needed to. And in the last year of the first arc of Love and Capes, essentially issues 13 to 18, it was supposed to be their newlywed year and they were supposed to get pregnant. And I went through two issues and I'm like, oh, they just bought a house. I'm not going to be able to get pregnant in this. So I had to expand it out and do a fourth year of it.
Okay.
But past that, like every individual story, I generally did not run out of pages. Like my brain just thinks in that those kind of increments. Same thing, actually, when I'm writing animation or when I'm writing spec scripts, I can usually come within a couple pages of what the number of pages you're supposed to have are because my brain just thinks with that kind of cadence.
Cool. Well, let's talk a little bit about yourself, Tom. Were you always a creative kid? Always drawing, always coming up with new stories and tales and whatnot?
I have no memory of not wanting to be a cartoonist. Like,
okay.
It's all I've ever wanted to do.
Was that because of Saturday morning cartoons, or what was the catalyst for that?
My dad taught me to read when I was 2.5.
Okay.
He he was real Machiavellian about it. He read this book that said there's no reason a two-year-old can't read. And we would do like phonics pages and do three pages and then stop so that I would keep saying, let's do more. And he's like, no, we'll do more tomorrow. And then taught me to read. So comics were always part of my life and they were like a reward system. So since I could read comics, my dad bought me comics and I just fell in love with them and said, this is what I want to do. And my dad had done art for a little bit. My aunt had done art for a little bit. My grandpa did a little bit. That whole side of the family is artistic and crafty. So it was always kind of an option. So it wasn't like really trying to convince them that art was a career. Like everybody knew it was. They knew it was tough, but it was, you know, it wasn't like saying I'm going to play in the NBA. Like mm-hmm. people knew that there are artists who get work. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was just, yeah, it's been in my blood the whole time.
And your family obviously was supportive when you said, hey, I want to become an artist.
Yes, my dad was very supportive. My mom, she's the one who, using the NBA analogy, it's not that she didn't think I could do it. She just thought there was a lot of competition and wanted me to have a backup plan. And I had based my entire life on a line from Dark Knight. Can't have a back door. Might be tempted to use it. I didn't want to be the best artist running a record store. So the deal was that if I got good grades, I could go wherever I wanted to school. So I got my Phi Beta Kappa, National Merit Scholar, 4.0, all that stuff. And I said, all right, I want to go to the Kubert School. And there's no scholarships. Time to go. But she put me through school and she is my biggest fan now. You know, once she saw it was working, she was on board. I remember talking to her once after San Diego one year, and I've got four brothers, and she says, I'm just making sure you got work coming in. I'm like, yeah, I do. Why? And she's like, well, I want to be treated in the manner to which I've become accustomed. I'm like, but you got four other kids. You got like a teacher, a lawyer, a engineer, an architect. And she's just like, yeah, but I know which one's got the money. So yeah, she's great.
Real quickly, talking about the Kubert School, I recently was speaking to another guest and they had shared the story that they attempted to go and they went out for kind of like a, I guess a campus visit, you would say, right? The reason why she did not go there was it seemed like there was kind of an intensity that she was not really comfortable with. Is the Kubert School, in your humble opinion, is it challenging? What was your opinion and your experience there?
Retroactively, because I think schools change. So I know what the school was like when I, you know, around the time that I went there in the early 90s. It was boot camp for artists. I had 10 classes a week, 2.5 hours each class. I had done 100 assignments by the time I went home for Thanksgiving. Like, it'll grind you down. But if you go through it, yes, you'll be able to do some amazing things. I didn't appreciate at the time, and I did later, and I actually got to talk to him about it, that Joe's training us to be Will Eisner, because that's not what companies were looking for in the 90s, but I can draw, ink, letter, color. Like, I will work for my own crappy rates, so I can create books when I want to. Like, I don't mm-hmm. have to get anyone else involved. That is an incredible blessing to be able to do. And yeah, it was really, the pace was intense. Like the learning would come at the pace you were comfortable with, but the volume of work that you had to turn out was pretty, pretty insane.
Okay. So who are some of your inspirations?
Kurt Swan, George Perez were the first guys that I wanted to be like. Mm-hmm. And then I found out I couldn't be them. It was fighting against type. And I was always attracted to Kurt Schaffenberger. He drew Shazam for a while. He did a lot of Lois Lane stories in the 50s and 60s. But everything really turned around when Batman animated series came out. Mm-hmm. Because suddenly, like, you saw how a cartoony style could work. Darwin Cook was a giant influence and a pal in that order. And yeah, once I stopped trying to draw super realistically and super detailed, it was like finding out you could hit the outside curve. And it's like, I can do this all day. Like, this is the, you know, I stopped trying to fight it and started going into what I had a natural inclination for. And I think that's when it really took off.
Cool. So real quickly, I know we're audio only here, but yeah. In the background, I have to ask, Is that an old Boba Fett from like 1977, like Kenner?
No, it is the Super 7 Boba Fett that's designed to be a Shogun Warrior because he's right next to another Shogun Warrior.
I was going to ask if that was another Shogun Warrior as well. That's one of my prized possessions when I was a kid is I have the first three issues of Shogun's Warriors.
Oh, really? And
yeah, the individual issues I got, like it was a three pack that you got right. Like, at Sears or whatever, mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And not that I was a huge fan of them, but they were so cool because they were giant robots.
And oh, yeah. Like, oh,
this is cool. And then I got one at a yard sale, and Ray Dean is actually who I got.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, all the missiles were missing. So I was So I'm like, well, yeah, it was garage sale, fine, you know. Yeah.
Uh-huh. That one back there is missing a few. The Boba Fett's in pretty good condition. I bought it new, but it has a backpack rocket launcher, and somehow that my nephew was in town and we noticed that the launcher is kind of broken. Like it launches, but the tab that you press down somehow broke off. I blame it on my cats.
Okay. Well, do you have any other cool retro toys? And cause you're in your studio. Do you have anything
in my studio?
Else
yeah. Let's see. There's a statue of Figment back there from Disney on a pedestal. Cause he's kind of like I used to have, there's a glass shelf that goes around the length of the room, and it was all filled with action figures, but it got really dusty. So I'm trying to, I haven't had the money to like seal those in so they don't get as dusty, but I'd like to do that because I loved having all the action figures up. And then I've got a piece of Darwin Cook art right here when he did the cover for Love and Capes next to my Cuber School diploma, which has a caveman on it, which not all, any of my college friends can say. And then there's a picture of when Stan Lee met my mom at Baltimore, which is, you never really think that Stan Lee is going to meet your mother. Like, you're just kind of not ready for that.
Was it like in the 70s or something? Or like,
no,
when was
no.
it? Like, it was more recent? Or
2011?
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
He was in Baltimore. He was there for the Harvey Awards. Okay. And my mom, I think it was the first year that I was nominated, might have been the second, but she came to the awards ceremony, and we were at the cocktail party beforehand, and I got to introduce Stan Lee to my mom, and I had designed, there were these Stan Lee drinking glasses that I did the art for, and it's funny, and I know my mom will never listen to this interview, so this is what happened. So Stan Lee, I go up to him, I remind him who I am because I've met him like a dozen times, but he's Stan Lee. Like he can meet me for the first time every time. He knows plenty, but I let him know that I did the glasses. So I brought him over to my mom and he's like, your son is so talented because he had such a good subject to work with. And like, it was this perfect, like Stan Lee, like his art is so good because I'm so attractive kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But my mom heard it as Stan Lee knows who my son is. And now when she tells this story, she's like, Stan Lee said my son is so talented because he can write and he can draw and he can aim. Like, that's not what he said, but I'm not going to disabuse you of it. You can have that just that way. That's fine with me. Like, but yeah, hang on just a second. It's often the, this is the, and like, she's just delighted in that photo. That's just, I love everything about it. It's often the, on my Facebook page, it's my cover photo.
And I would like to just real quickly, I want anybody out there that was thinking I was making some type of snarky comment about your mother's age when I go, was it in the 70s? I was not. So I would like to publicly apologize to your mom.
well, yeah, it's just one of those things that like, you know who Stan Lee is and you've seen him at conventions. You know who your mom is because you were there. But like, you just don't expect those streams to cross. And like, when you hear someone has met somebody like that who's been around for so long, of course you think that they met him somewhere else and not in the course of my career. Yeah.
All right. Well, Tom, let's let folks know where they can pick up your comics. I know you have a great website, but go ahead and run that down for us.
Yeah. My website is tomz.com, TOMZ.com. All my books are available there. You can also go to Amazon. There's lots of stuff up there. Most of the Pony stuff is there. Warning Labels there. I think the Love and Capes books are up there. Definitely Time and Vine. And then I am seemingly at every comic book convention in the country. Apparently all you do is say my name three times and they book me. So I'll be at Heroes Con in a couple weeks. I'll be at San Diego, Dragon Con, Baltimore, all over the place.
Okay. Do you have any projects that people should keep an eye out for? I mean, upcoming projects.
Yes. I am doing a book for Storm King that I can't talk about, which is John Carpenter's company. I am doing a book called Molang for Source Point Press. I'm drawing that, which is based on the cartoon Molang. And I am working feverishly on doing Cupid Zeros as a trade collection. Cupid Zeros was canceled by Webtoon, but the story isn't over, and we're going to figure out a way to do volumes 3 and 4 directly through Rocket Ship Publishing.
Okay.
So we're still working out those details, but we'll continue the story straight to print and not as a webcomic anymore.
Okay. What, do you have any social medias that you would like to let us know about? Or we could follow you.
Yeah. I'm at Tom Zahler everywhere, TomZahler. I'm on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Patreon. I think Patreon is the one that I update the most. I've just kind of, I'm on social media, but I don't post a ton. Just because, I mean, half the time it feels like, you know, the chances of me posting something will get me in trouble are pretty great. So.
And it's always the dumbest thing to get you in trouble, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I was talking to a buddy of mine about like why I'm not on there anymore. And, you know, it's like the opposite of the Hulk and the Avengers. Like, I just don't like being angry all the time.
Well, Tom, thanks for coming on. Really do appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And thank with you that, me. You're quite welcome. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to throw it to a quick break. And on the other side of the break, I'll be back to wrap up the episode. Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen, my conversation with Tom Zahler, talking about his various different books and projects, from Love and Capes to Warning Label to Time and Vine to Cupid's Arrows to My Little Pony, etc., etc. Definitely check out Tom's stuff, and as you heard, he's going to be all over the place making appearances from one coast to the other coast, so if you happen to be at a convention, Tom is there. Stop by and say hello. Well, with that out of the way, ladies and gentlemen, now it's time for me to tell you where you can get in touch with me if you choose to do so. You can shoot me an email if you like. johnorlando@pvdcast.com is my email address. You can find me on Twitter. My personal Twitter handle is @pvdmvp. You can leave me a message over on the Facebook and Instagram feeds of the podcast. Simply look for @pvdcast. And, of course, let everybody know about my great podcast. And there's a bunch of different ways that you can hear it. First off, pvdcast.com is the online home of yours truly and probably the easiest way to get every episode, but it's available through all of those major podcasting outlets, you know, like Spotify, Stitcher Radio, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio app, etc., etc. Go to your favorite podcasting app, go to the search bar, put in PVDcast. Sometimes you have to put my name after it, and you should find it. And if you are listening through one of those apps, please rate and review. It helps me out on the algorithm. And of course, subscribe so that you never miss an episode of the PVDcast. But there are a couple of other ways that you can hear the PVDcast. First of all, every Wednesday night, 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, I do a little Facebook broadcast through the Facebook page. And the show is even available through Internet Radio, CROC Radio out of British Columbia, a premier internet radio station. I'm happy to be part of the family. Probably the easiest way to listen to it on Croc is just to very easily go over to their Facebook page. Just search for Croc Community Radio, and they have a list of all the different avenues. I mean, it's circulated a lot of places. And once again, I appreciate the opportunity to be part of Croc Radio. All right, with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to get on out of here. I thank you all for checking out the episode. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I will chat at each and every one of you later. Stay righteous, stay independent, and stay safe and healthy. following has been a presentation of John Orlando Enterprises, LLC, copyright 2022.